Well, thanks so much for having me here. In fact, this is my first trip to the Mises Institute, and I really enjoyed it very much. The topic I'll be covering is the Second World War, and obviously that's a very, very big topic. In fact, you know, not only was the Second World War the greatest military struggle in the history of the human race, but it's the founding event of the modern world. In other words, the entire world in which we live largely was created with its structures by the consequences of the Second World War. And given the enormous importance of the Second World War, there's naturally probably an assumption on the part of most people that the basic facts of the war are well known. It's in all our history books. There have probably been thousands, maybe even tens of thousands of books written by the Second World War. It's, you know, endless movies, endless documentaries. And, you know, I'm the sort of person who, until probably about 15 years ago, I never really had any suspicions that the basic histories I'd been taught in my college courses or absorbed from the media, movies, newspapers, magazines, television, that sort of thing, was any different than the actual history of what had happened. And, you know, it was only gradually that I started realizing that there are many, many things in our past that are very, very different, that the reality of the world is very, very different than what has been portrayed in our media. When people nowadays, you know, to try to get people to start suspecting the same thing, it may be a little bit easier now because the internet is much more powerful. There's so much social media. There's so many things, so many dramatic and surprising things have happened over the last few years. And in fact, you know, one thing I think that also makes people more open to reevaluating some of these past events are the very recent events. Take, for example, the Ukraine war right now. I mean, the media for years has constantly said the unprovoked Russian attack on Ukraine. And everybody now who has any grain of sense, who's looked into it, knows that that's not at all true. I mean, for example, John Mearsheimer, one of our most respected political scientists, his lecture, his 2014 lecture on what would probably happen in Ukraine, has been watched 30 million times on the internet, tens of millions of times. People have watched other lectures, other discussions. I mean, there's such a huge amount of content by leading academic scholars, very respectable people, showing that what the media has been telling us about the events of the last few years is entirely untrue. And so logically, if people realize that what the media is telling us about the here and now is so totally false, it's much easier for them to accept that they might have been misled about what happened 50, 60, 80, 90 years ago. And that, I think, maybe makes people much more open to reevaluating their understanding of the Second World War. Now, I think if people are sort of trying to look at the true history of the Second World War, you know, the cartoon image, Adolf Hitler tried to conquer the world and America heroically organized the Allies to defeat him. I think a very good starting point is actually a book published almost 65 years ago by A.J.P. Taylor. Now, A.J.P. Taylor was one of Oxford's greatest academic scholars. He, you know, was regarded as one of the greatest British historians, and he published a book called Origins of the Second World War in 1961. I mean, probably some of the people here in the audience probably weren't even born in 1961. That was the year I was born. So, you know, we're talking about something very long ago. And he basically laid out the case that the origins of the war were totally different than what it was being portrayed in the media at the time. In other words, basically, Hitler certainly did not want to get into a war with the Allies, with the British or French. And it was only a British diplomatic blunder, in other words, giving a blank check to Poland over the Danzig question, that really resulted in the war breaking out. Now, you know, at the time I ended up reading, A.J.P. Taylor's book was on my freshman college reading list. So, you know, I read it at the time. I thought, yeah, it seems to make a lot of sense. And then around the time of the 70th anniversary of the outbreak of the war, Pat Buchanan's book, you know, The Unnecessary War, just come out at the time. I'd read it and really thought it was quite good. And, you know, that prompted me to then reread A.J.P. Taylor's book. And again, very impressive book, you know, certainly impressed me again. And then, you know, I also, on the cover of the book, it had some of the, you know, glowing praise it received. Remember, we're talking about somebody, a top British historian, who debunked the standard version of the mainstream narrative of the origins of the Second World War in 1961. The Washington Post gave him a glowing review, described him as possibly the greatest living British historian. All of these other publications, the New Statesman, World Politics, the Times Literary Supplement, they all praised his work to the skies. And we're talking about a book that came out in 1961, totally debunking the standard narrative of the Second World War. But what I then discovered when I looked into it is, you know, despite the fact that it became a huge bestseller, it was on college reading lists for decades to come. It received all this international praise. It generated so much controversy that A.J.P. Taylor, described by the Washington Post as the greatest living British historian, was purged from Oxford as a consequence. In other words, he was removed after 25 years of teaching at Oxford. He was removed from his teaching position. And that's the sort of reason that, you know, at the beginning of his book, he said how strange it was that, you know, 16 years after the war, nobody had still published a solid analysis of how the war broke out. And when he was removed from his Oxford post, I mean, that maybe gave him a better idea of why nobody had done something like that before. Now, what's interesting is tracing the history of purges regarding the Second World War, and there are really so many of them. One reason I started becoming very suspicious about all these historical events is in the early 2000s, I ended up spending some time digitizing the archives of many of our leading publications, mainstream publications, The Atlantic Monthly, The New Republic, Harper's, Foreign Affairs, you know, National Review, all these publications. And, you know, as I went through and digitized these publications, I sometimes noticed that there were certain writers who were some of the most frequently appearing writers in these mainstream publications. You know, they had hundreds of articles in these publications, and I'd never once heard of their names. And, you know, I gradually discovered that there had been a great American purge around 1940 in which some of America's most prominent public intellectuals, journalists, academics had been removed from public affairs, removed from the media, because they had opposed America's involvement in the Second World War. You know, men like John T. Flynn, Harry Elmer Barnes, a little bit later, William Henry Chamberlain, Charles Beard. Charles Beard was probably, you know, one of the greatest historians, regarded for decades as one of the greatest historians in American public life. He was president of the American Historical Society, president of the American Political Science Association, and he basically, he couldn't get his book published, he barely could get his book published about the Second World War. So, you know, when you start looking at the results as what these people had written about the events of that period, you come to some very shocking discoveries. And in fact, one of the things I stumbled across was, you know, the work of, for example, John T. Flynn. Because I digitized his archives, and he had hundreds of columns in the New Republic. He was one of the leading progressive columnists in America. And in early January 1938, he had a New Republic column that I just happened to stumble across, where at that point, basically in late 1937, the Great Depression had come back again, despite all of Roosevelt's policies. In other words, all these years of New Deal, Roosevelt had gotten reelected, but unemployment had spiked back up to the same levels that it had when Roosevelt had first come in. And so Flynn was talking with the top Roosevelt advisor and said, you know, what are you going to do? You're in a box. I mean, you've already had all these New Deal policies. You've tried everything. None of it has worked, and unemployment is back again. So, you know, there's no way you can solve the problem. And the Roosevelt advisor said, oh, don't worry about it. We know exactly how to start it. What we're going to do is have a bout of military Keynesianism. We're going to get America involved in a major war. Once we get America involved in a major war, that then will generate so much economic, production that basically we'll get out of the problem. And then when you look at, for example, the records, the statements, the, you know, private memos of, for example, the British ambassador, the Polish ambassador, their private documents, the American ambassador to Britain, all of them emphasize that FDR put tremendous pressure on the Polish government, the British government, all of these European governments, not to settle the Danzig boundary dispute with Germany. And the intention, obviously, was to make sure that a war would break out that would give America the sort of burst of military Keynesianism that would solve Roosevelt's economic problems. So, you know, again, when a top American advisor to the President of the United States a couple of years earlier says, we're going to get America involved in a war, and nobody at that time was imagining there was any war on the horizon. And when exactly that ends up happening, you know, the combination seems much more likely than coincidental. So, in other words, you know, these are the things. You have these buried bits of evidence in these documents, in these memoirs, in these statements that really show how the whole thing happened. Another writer, you know, again, purged much later, came generations later, is David Irving. I mean, David Irving clearly ranks as one of the greatest historians, world historians of the 20th century. In fact, I think you can probably make a case he was possibly the single most internationally successful British historian of the last 100 years in terms of sales of his books. Probably Arnold Toynbee was the only one, you know, who might be in the same category. The works that Irving did, you know, drawing on all these firsthand documents are really just very, very important for understanding the Second World War from especially, obviously, the British point of view or the German point of view. And, you know, they, I think, will rank as the sort of works that 50 years from now, 100 years from now, will be viewed by scholars as central to understanding of that period. And one of, I think, Irving's most dramatic discoveries, at least from my point of view, was that Winston Churchill and many of the other key British leaders were actually being financially bribed by international interests to get Britain involved in a war. In other words, and you know, at the time he published that book, I mean, it generated huge controversy. In other words, he seemed to have the documentation. But, I mean, it was just shocking. But it turns out 30 years after Churchill had written that book, his Churchill, you know, Churchill's War, where he had, you know, this material on the financial pressures that Churchill was facing at the time. A man named David Loft, who was a financial journalist, ended up publishing a similar book, actually with the cooperation of the Churchill family. So in other words, he was given full access to all of Churchill's financial documents. And he confirmed all of basically Irving's results. And even more, he discovered more things. For example, at the time Churchill became prime minister, in the middle of one of the months, at the end of that month, he was facing personal bankruptcy. In other words, imagine, you become prime minister, and basically he had huge debts that were coming due at the end of that same month. And he barely escaped personal bankruptcy. So in other words, when somebody is totally under the financial control of other, you know, forces, I mean, that basically means he's essentially a puppet. And that, you know, was why Churchill and some of these other groups put such tremendous pressure on Chamberlain and the British government not to settle, not to, you know, have a peace agreement with Germany. And, you know, at the time, and for example, after the Germans ended up winning the war against Poland, they tried to then settle the war. After they then defeated the French a few months later, again, they tried to settle the war. But the British refused to settle, and that's sort of what ended up happening at that point. Now, there are, again, so many different aspects of the Second World War that are so shocking. Another very interesting book that came out about just over 25 years ago, was a very mainstream professor named Joseph Bendersky, an American scholar, actually a Holocaust scholar. He ended up spending 10 years reviewing the private documents of American military intelligence, you know, the private papers of many of our generals, the internal declassified documents of American military intelligence. And he came to some very shocking discoveries of what these military officers, you know, again, America's leading military experts, had said at the time about the nature of the war. And he essentially confirmed the views that had been published by a man named basically John Beatty. And the Beatty book is probably a book probably many of you may not have heard of unless you've read my own writings. In 1951, a man named John Beatty published a book called The Iron Curtain Over America. Beatty was a mainstream academic scholar, professor of English at Southern Methodist University. You know, he had a military reserve commission. So when the war began, he ended up was called into service, and he spent the entire war as a military intelligence officer, but a very important military intelligence officer. He was responsible during the Second World War for producing the daily intelligence briefs that were distributed to everyone at the White House, all of our top military commanders, all of our top officials. So in other words, he was responsible for collating all the intelligence information that was acquired every 24 hours and producing a brief that would go out to all of our top officials. And, you know, there's really probably nobody in the war who had a better idea of what actually was going on. When he published his book in 1951, he really denounced the official history of the war and basically said exactly the same thing that, you know, Taylor and to some extent Irving and all of these other people had said, that, you know, in a sense, the war was basically unnecessary. It was brought about because of the Roosevelt administration's desire to start the war. And it, you know, was really just entirely, as Pat Buchanan said, an entirely unnecessary war. And Beatty's views were very, very similar to that of our entire military intelligence officer corps. Now, at the time, that was before the NSA was created. That was before the CIA was created in the Second World War. So military intelligence at that point constituted really almost our entire national security establishment. In other words, it was responsible for all of our national security policies. And again, all the officers ended up saying the same things privately that Beatty was saying in his book. And Beatty's book ended up being endorsed by about a dozen of our top generals from the Second World War. So again, you know, very, very high-ranking people endorsed this book. They said, finally, somebody has published the truth of the Second World War. And it became a gigantic national bestseller. It received virtually no media coverage. So, for example, if you go through the archives of the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post, you'll see almost no mention of it. But it ended up becoming the second best conservative seller of the 1950s. So, you know, we're talking about a book that sold enormous numbers of copies as well as endorsed by our top generals. And it gave exactly the same interpretation of the war as these other scholars had given. So, you know, we're talking about a situation where basically those aspects of the war, you know, have been published over the years by very knowledgeable mainstream people, and they simply have not gotten into the electronic media. You don't see films about it. You don't see TV shows about it. You don't see it discussed in our daily newspapers and our magazines. So in other words, the material's out there. Anybody can read it, but it simply doesn't get into broad circulation. Once the war broke out, you know, again, the Second World War is a very, very broad topic, so I'm just trying to outline some of the more surprising aspects of the war that have not gotten a lot of attention, and I'll try to leave some time for Q&A at the end. There's something else that really could have had a dramatic impact on the course of the war. It's fully documented. All the archival information is there. It's actually been published in mainstream academic volumes, but virtually nobody in America or the rest of the world is aware of it, and that's called something called Operation Pike. It turns out, you know, people know, all of you know the course of the Second World War, you know, how it was won, that, you know, the Germans then attacked the Soviet Union and that brought in the Soviets, then America got involved in the war. It turns out in early 1940, the Allies, the British and French, had decided to attack the Soviet Union. I mean, it sounds utterly bizarre. And, you know, the first time you hear it, you can't believe it's true. But yes, basically, because of the Stalin-Hitler Pact, you know, which started the war, in other words, where they divided Poland, the Soviet Union was regarded as sort of Hitler's ally at the time, Hitler's quasi-ally, the source of Hitler's raw materials, the source of Hitler's energy supplies. And so the British and French, at the time decided that actually the Soviet Union was probably relatively weak. So they decided, you know, defeating the Germans would be difficult, but what they would do to sort of win the war was to launch a sudden attack against Stalin's Soviet Union. What they planned was the largest strategic bombing offensive in the history of the world to destroy the Soviet oil fields in Baku. They believed that the Soviets were supplying oil to the German economy. In other words, the German war machine was dependent upon, you know, Soviet oil supplies. That actually was mistaken. Most of the oil was coming from Romania instead, but, you know, wartime they didn't know that. So they basically had planned an all-out attack on Stalin's Soviet Union. The only reason the attack did not go ahead was that it was delayed a few times, it was delayed. And then suddenly the Germans poured into France and defeated the French army and seized Paris. So in other words, at that point, you know, the French knocked out of the war. They couldn't be involved in the attack against the Soviet Union. But I mean, that story, the fact that the Allies had planned to attack the Soviet Union in early 1940, has never been reported on our media. And it obviously would have turned the course of the entire war. Because if Stalin had been brought into the war as Hitler's military ally, it's certain that Hitler and Stalin together would have won the war and easily defeated the British and French. Not only that, but because Stalin's agents, his Soviet operatives, had so much influence in the Washington of that time, you know, if the Allies, if the British and French were at outright war with Stalin's Soviet Union, Stalin's agents in the United States would have certainly ensured that American support would have never, you know, been given at any high levels for, you know, the British or French. So in other words, it would certainly turn the course of the war. And it's fully documented. It turns out the Germans actually captured, when they seized Paris, they captured all the diplomatic archives dealing with all the details of it. So they published it in facsimile and translation. It was known to everybody at the time. But the story of how the Allies were on the verge of attacking the Soviet Union, and, you know, which would have resulted in their defeat in the war, was so embarrassing. It's been left out of virtually every history book published in 75 years. So in other words, you know, again, it's solidly established. A few people have written about it. All the documents are there. The monographs are there. But, you know, it's such an embarrassing story. Nobody basically has put it into print. Another unknown aspect of the Second World War, which, you know, in a sense is on the other side of it, is there really seems to be very strong evidence that when Hitler attacked the Soviet Union in 1941, Operation Barbarossa, the Soviets were on the verge of launching a massive offensive to seize all of Europe. In other words, Stalin had spent the previous 2 years building up a gigantic military force, the largest military force ever seen in the history of the world. Stalin had more and better tanks than every other country in the world combined. Many, many times more tanks and planes than Hitler's armies did. And when Hitler attacked, one reason he was able to be as successful as he was is the Soviets were assembling their forces right on the border. They put all their forces on the border, and they were in the process of sort of setting up their army of invasion. So Hitler was lucky enough to strike them at exactly the time when they were most vulnerable, and that's why he was successful as he is. And so, you know, the notion, for example, that if Hitler's attack had been delayed for a few months, or even maybe a few weeks, a gigantic Soviet army of invasion would have swept through and occupied all of Europe. I mean, the Soviets, for example, had actually built a huge number of amphibious tanks that were specifically designed to cross the English Channel and occupy Britain. In other words, you know, again, we're talking about a massive effort that the Soviets had spent 2 years assembling. And that, again, has been written out of all of our history books. This first really came to light when a Soviet defecting military intelligence officer named Viktor Suvorov ended up publishing his original book. I think it probably would have been 1988, 1989, something like that. And Suvorov became then, you know, once the Soviet Union collapsed, millions of his copies were bought by Soviets. It became very popular in Germany. It's received virtually no attention in the Anglosphere. Viktor Suvorov probably became the single most widely read military historian in the history of the world, with 5 million copies of his books in print, and I'd never heard of it. In other words, virtually nobody in the English language world had ever heard of these things. And so, you know, we're talking about basically, you know, things that had such a potential, dramatic potential impact on the Second World War. Or take, for example, the whole issue of Pearl Harbor. America then got involved in the war, obviously because of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, and it's pretty well recognized based on documents and memoirs and minutes that America put tremendous pressure on Japan, hoping to provoke a Japanese attack. In fact, you know, it was called by Charles Tansel, a diplomatic historian at the time, the backdoor to war. In other words, Roosevelt was trying to get America involved in the European war, encountering tremendous opposition, domestic opposition from the America First movement and things like that. So what he ended up doing then was basically putting pressure in Japan, trying to provoke a Japanese attack. There's also, over the years, been a tremendous amount of speculation and some evidence that since we had broken the Japanese codes, we knew that the Japanese attack was coming and that Roosevelt deliberately allowed the attack to proceed. There's really been quite a lot of evidence for it, but one tidbit, one aspect of that, which I think, to my mind, pretty much confirms it, it's not widely known, but of the major Hollywood studios at that point, all of them were supportive of an American involvement in the Second World War, with the sole exception of the Disney studios. The Disney studios were opposed. You know, the Disney, Walt Disney was more on the, you know, anti-war side. It turns out, the morning after the Pearl Harbor attack, American military forces suddenly occupied the Disney studios. They poured into the Disney studios and seized control of the Disney studios and occupied them for the next 6 months. Now, what's interesting about that is the Pearl Harbor attack, and the excuse they used was to defend California from a Japanese invasion. In other words, the Japanese were thousands of miles away, but they needed to occupy not just any part of California, but the Disney studios to protect California from a Japanese invasion. But the interesting thing about it is the military occupation of the Disney studios began first thing Monday morning. The Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor had taken place on a Sunday, the previous Sunday. So, you know, normally when you think about it, if there's suddenly a totally surprising attack on American military forces destroying our fleet in the Pacific, you would think that the American government would be preoccupied with other things rather than deciding to set up an occupation of the Disney studios. Yet the military forces were in place so that they began the occupation early Monday morning. And I think that is the smoking gun proof that they knew exactly what was about to take place, that they knew, you know, that basically the Japanese were about to attack. So, you know, we're talking about all of these shocking developments. And the whole thing about it is, once you discover a few of these surprises, and once you convince people a few of these tremendous, shocking things are true, it makes people obviously much more willing to accept other things as well. Take, for example, you know, the whole issue of the Nuremberg trials and, you know, the sort of, you know, these horrible atrocities the Nazis supposedly committed. I mean, you know, when you really go through and look at it, I mean, many of the issues raised at the Nuremberg trials are obviously false. I mean, you know, again, there had been all these accusations of human skin, lampshades, shrunken heads. I mean, all of it was totally nonsense. Nobody believes in it these days. I mean, one of the things the Nazis were accused of at the Nuremberg trials by the Soviet prosecutor was that they'd massacred the Polish officer corps at the Katyn Forest. And everybody knew at the time it was basically the Stalin. It was the Soviets who done it. And, you know, and the Soviet prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials was the same man who'd been the chief Soviet prosecutor at the Stalin purge trials a few years earlier. You know, when all these old Bolsheviks had, you know, admitted publicly that they were all Nazi spies, all these Jewish old Bolsheviks said, oh yes, we've spent our whole career as Nazi spies or something like that. And so, you know, again, we're talking about basically utter nonsense. And in fact, the interesting thing about it is the Nuremberg trials then were denounced at the time by so many respectable people, like Robert Taft ended up, you know, denouncing them as just an outrageous, you know, violation of justice. John F. Kennedy, in his Profiles in Courage book, you know, huge national bestseller, praised Robert Taft for his denunciation of the Nuremberg trials. And there are a lot of other people, like, for example, I'd mentioned John Beatty, again, our chief who'd been at the center of American intelligence activity during the Second World War. The biggest, and he then published the biggest conservative bestseller, second biggest conservative bestseller of the 1950s. He, again, denounced the Nuremberg trials as just sort of an outrageous violation of justice. And that gets also into a very interesting aspect of, you know, again, the whole Jewish angle in the Second World War. You know, again, one of the, nowadays probably, you know, and for the last couple of generation or so, people view the Second World War as being sort of almost a subset of the Holocaust. In other words, the Holocaust has become such a gigantic issue. Probably more people are aware of the Holocaust than aware of the Second World War. It turns out that was not the case in the 1950s. And when John Beatty published his book, again, one of the biggest bestsellers of that period, backed and endorsed by a dozen of our top generals, in that book, he basically had a couple of paragraphs where he just casually mentioned how there was this ridiculous wartime propaganda that some people were calling the Holocaust, or that, you know, 6 million Jews had been killed. He just dismissed it as like ridiculous wartime propaganda that nobody still believed anymore. His book then, you know, since it raised all these controversial issues, was ferociously attacked by the ADL and by lots of these, you know, Jewish organizations. It was attacked on all these different grounds. Nobody ever attacked his dismissal of the Holocaust. So in other words, basically, when you have a book like that, the second best-selling conservative book of the 1950s, endorsed by a dozen of our top generals who praised it to the skies, attacked for some of the issues it raised by the ADL and all these activist organizations, who never challenged his dismissal of the Holocaust, as far as I can tell, virtually none of the mainstream media of the 1950s ever believed in the Holocaust or mentioned anything about it. That also raises one other very strange aspect of the Second World War that people are not aware of, though it's totally documented. During the 1930s, there actually had been a very strong quasi-alliance between the mainstream Zionist movement and Nazi Germany. In other words, Nazi Germany supplied 70% of the economic development aid to the Zionist movement in Palestine. In other words, if not for the support coming from Nazi Germany, probably the state of Israel would never have been created. And so, you know, what amounted to almost a quasi-alliance between the Zionist movement and the German Nazis in the Second World War in the 1930s. Then once the war broke out, the more right-wing Zionist faction of Yitzhak Shamir, who ended up becoming a prime minister of Israel, actually tried to enlist in the Allies' powers as a Hitler ally. In other words, they made an effort in 1940 and 1941 to join the Axis alliance. And they offered then to provide, you know, intelligence support, espionage activity, and then sabotage operations against the British on behalf of the Germans. So, you know, again, I mean, we're talking about basically what amounted to an effort on the part of the sort of Zionist faction led by future Prime Minister of Israel to join Hitler's wartime alliance. And that yields possibly one of the strangest, most unusual aspects of the whole thing. Back about 30 years ago, there was a book came out by Gordon Thomas, a sort of, you know, very mainstream, well-regarded intelligence writer, an 800-page history of Israel's Mossad based on dozens of Israeli and Mossad sources and everything like that, you know, very sort of weighty history. I ended up reading it a couple of years ago. And Yitzhak Shamir later then became head of assassinations for the Israeli Mossad for a number of years. And then he became prime minister in two terms of prime minister in the 1980s and then in the early 1990s. And he had very bad relations with the United States, with George H.W. Bush over loan guarantees and everything like that. In the book, and, you know, again, based on all these Israeli sources, it was mentioned that Yitzhak Shamir had a seething hatred of the United States. He'd always had a seething hatred of the United States, which didn't surprise me too much because I'd sort of gotten that impression from some of his other statements or reading. But the interesting thing was the reason he hated the United States. Apparently, his seething hatred of America came from the fact that he had never forgiven the United States for failing to support Adolf Hitler in the Second World War. We're talking about the Israeli prime minister of the time. So, you know, those are the sorts of details that, you know, really surprise a lot of people when they learn about them. So anyway, that's, you know, I think I've ended up using up most of my time. Well, thank you.